special privilege of getting to sing the song before the lesson with special insight when you know you've got a song leader that puts some effort into it. And I don't think anybody else, not knowing what's about to be said, can fully appreciate just how well, you know, Josh's Be Thou My Vision applied to the message tonight. I appreciate him for that. That doesn't just happen by accident. I understand that. The lesson tonight is going to have within it all of the makings of a best-selling romance novel. You got lust, betrayal, deception, murder, the cover-up, and what might sound like a blockbuster hit or some drama today is really a message from 2 Samuel chapter 11 and chapter 12. Verses 1 through 17 really just tell the story. There's more there. For time's sake, let's just tell the story of chapter 11, 1 through 17. It happened in the spring of the year at the time when kings go out to battle that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. For she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. And the woman conceived. So she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing, and how the people were doing, and how the war prospered. And David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his house," David said to Uriah, "Did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Wait here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him, that he may be struck down and die." So it was, while Joab besieged the city, that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. This is obviously the lowest point of King David, servant of God. A man who is described as a man after God's own heart. You may recall that when King Saul offered that sacrifice in 1 Samuel chapter 13, and Samuel returned right afterwards, and he said, "Well, why did you do it? Why did you not wait for me? I was afraid. You didn't come. You said you'd come." Right after that, Samuel says, "Because you have done this thing, God has rejected you, and he has chosen for himself a man who will obey all his will, a man after his own heart." 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. But we read this story, and the question that all of us wonder, and it's just the obvious question that shouts at us from this, is how could a man be described as a man after God's own heart who was capable of something like this? Is this what you would describe was a man after God's own heart? Would you not think that having done these things, even at any point in your life, that that disqualified you from being characterized in that way? The idea of just being capable of that, you would think was too much. Certainly had gone too far to ever be characterized in that way. This was a man who at one time in his life was unwilling to defend his own life, was unwilling to strike down King Saul, who had been pursuing him and at many times had tried to kill him, and said, "No, I will not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed." This after having already been told, "David, you are the next man. You've been anointed. You are the next king. Here's your opportunity." Having people feeding him lines saying, "Here's your opportunity. This is no doubt God delivering him into your hand. Do it. Take the throne." With all indicators pointing to defend yourself, take your place on the throne. I'm not gonna dare touch the Lord's anointed. How far he has fallen, that he would now reach out his hand and touch one of his own faithful, valiant men. This is the same man that wanted to build a house for the Lord because he himself dwelt in a nice house and could not see the Ark of God abide in a tent any longer. This is the same man who stood in an open field and trash-talked a trained killer who was almost twice his size. And that without modern weapons to defend himself. He used 5 stones and a sling. Again, how could this man have fallen so far? Some lessons for us in all of this. First of all, I want you to go back to the beginning of the story and note that perhaps there's something to the fact that in the previous chapter, in chapter 10, verse 19, after the Syrians are fleeing before him, David kills 700 charioteers, 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians. It says that they made peace with Israel. And they served them. And so God has given them peace. And perhaps there's something to be said about this, having been lulled into a sense of security and complacency, and because of the past victories that you have enjoyed, David, it's made him vulnerable. Like Gideon, who after all of his success, what Satan was not able to do by means of kind of going through the obvious approach, by means of the enemies of God, by means of challenging his faith, he was able to do in the back door with the ephod. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 9, you've got the words of Agur praying for not only, Lord, give me neither riches nor poverty, understanding that even in the with the blessings come the potential for temptation and for falling. Maybe there's something to be said about the fact that he was idle, that he wasn't occupying his time. Some have said that an idle mind is the devil's workshop. I don't know about that. It's not necessarily a biblical proverb, but there is something in the scriptures that have to do with the idleness of David. There's obviously a reference here to the fact that this was a time of year when the kings go out to battle, but very specifically stated, but David remained. For whatever reason, he's not with his men. He's not out defending and giving orders and protecting his men. Why is he there? Why is he sitting this one out? So maybe there's somebody who said that you need to remain busy. You need to stay busy and active. We only have so much time to work in life. And if we're not engaged actively, pursuing whatever our hands find to do with all of our might, maybe that will be a time that we'll be tempted to fall. Also, temptation can come in the most unlikely time and place, and therefore we need to be sober and vigilant. There's nothing said here. I don't see anything in the text to indicate that this was premeditated or that this was something that David anticipated seeing when he went out one evening, having arisen from his bed. But he just happened. I get the idea that he just happened to see the woman bathing, and it was hard for him to look away. I just direct your attention to the phrase one evening in verse 2. It happened one evening. And just appreciate the fact that that's all it takes for you and me to mess up our lives forever. Just one evening, one idle evening would change this man's life forever. Would ruin his life. One evening that he wasn't prepared for. Also, verse 3. I'm interested in the phrase, someone said. Who is it? We don't know. There's no name given there. But someone did. Someone was that voice in the back of David's head. Someone was the voice of conscience. Someone was not listened to, which is a lesson for us, in that we need to listen to the voice of our well-trained conscience. If properly trained, and if it's not yet been seared and hardened, then we're going to hear that sort of thing. We're going to have that fleeting thought that says, this is not right, I shouldn't do this, this is sin, this is going to destroy my life. Here's David at a crossroad. He's on his balcony. I don't know. Maybe he's like Peter. He went out there to pray. We just don't know what he was doing. Peter also going out on his roof in Acts chapter 10 for the purpose of praying. I don't know. But he's at a crossroad now. He's seen this woman. How important the covenant then is with one's eye. Job chapter 31. Job said, I've made a covenant with my eyes that I might not look at a woman to lust after her. Well, we can also be that voice for others. We ought to be. Verse 5, speaking of crossroads, there's that phrase that goes, all life concentrates on man at the crossroad. Here's another one. The woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, I am with child. There are so many crossroads, so many forks at which point David has a couple of options here. He's gone too far now. He's taken this woman. Now she's pregnant. He's going to have to reap what he has sown. And here's another crossroad. And in each case, he takes the wrong road all throughout this story. He takes the low road. But this is about, obviously, about 1 month later. And he chose to cover it up. So what's he going to do? He's going to send for Uriah. He's going to try to convince Uriah that this was his child. Amazingly, it's going to look just like the king, but hey, this is your child, right? Weren't you visiting right about that time? Yeah. But what we find out when that doesn't work, because Uriah is a man of honor, is that David is going to again be faced with a decision. What am I going to do about this? He didn't go down. He's got integrity. He's not going to go visit his wife. Because he's thinking of his brethren. He's mindful of the ark and Joab. How could I do this great evil? You know, and so he says, I will not go down to my house. And so David's next idea is, now I'm going to get him drunk. Certainly when his inhibitions are removed, he'll be, you know, he's a man. He's a normal man. He's going to have those natural urges like any man. Certainly if he's drunk, he's going to do it. And what we find out from this point is that Uriah is more principled while he is drunk than David is at this point. David, again, man after God's own heart is. He's got greater integrity, more principle, drunk than David when he is sober at this point. And so when that doesn't work, he decided that he had only one choice. One option presented itself. As a result of this, and after he had died, and by the way, you might add to the list of sins against David, was that he would have been rejoicing at the news of his death. When he was about to be upset about all the men that Joab had lost, there's something calming, something appeasing about that news when he learned that Uriah had died. Well, let's consider the consequences, because we might be tempted to think, you know, David, he got away with murder in all this. He got to keep the girl. He ends up marrying Bathsheba. He doesn't lose his life. I thought David was supposed to die. I mean, this was murder. Did he get away with murder? No, let's look at what happened. 2 Samuel chapter 12. And note how perfectly all of these punishments fit the crime. Verse 10, it says the sword would not depart from his house. It says that God would raise up evil in his house. It says his own companion would take his wives. And it says that the child would die because he'd given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. And we know that those things had come to pass just as God had promised that they would. First of all, we see that the sword not departing from the house came to pass when Amnon and Absalom had their little rift with one another, and Absalom ended up killing his brother Amnon over what he had done to Tamar. God would raise up evil in the house. You see that, of course, in that story as well. But what about the wives? 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 21. Absalom, obviously a key player in that as well, because of the advice given to him by Ahithophel, who said to him, in an effort to rally Israel behind Absalom as a public demonstration of his authority, Ahithophel advised, "Go into your father's concubines whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong." And then, finally, you got the death of the child. Something that was unsatisfactory, of course, to David. Something about which he prayed and fasted and begged the Lord multiple times that the child not die. But God, knowing that this child was going to, every time anybody wanted to say something evil about God, they'd have to do is look at that kid and blaspheme him, blaspheme the servant of God, call him a hypocrite, call, obviously, by extension, all Israelites are a bunch of hypocrites. Look at what their king does. And he got away with it. So God decided that couldn't come to pass. And the child died. And think of the great pain that Bathsheba endured, not only from the death of her son, but also from the news at hearing that Uriah, verse 26, Uriah, her husband, was dead also. And the guilt, I guess David thought he was doing her a great favor in making her a wife, but the guilt that she must have carried with her after having betrayed her husband, whose character we know well. What a great, valiant man, mighty man of war that he was. So honorable that when given a letter by the king, you know, I don't know if you're suspicious at this point, Uriah, or if he had no clue. But obviously he wasn't going to touch that letter, that he hand-delivered the letter with his own name inside, with a message of death written that he delivered by his own hand. David's life was ruined. It had come true according to the saying in Proverbs chapter 2, verse 19. Words spoken by David's son, who obviously would have been influenced by the legacy that his father had left for him. The true saying being, none who go, of course, not meaning to imply necessarily of Bathsheba that she fits the mold of this kind of woman that he's describing, but concerning in general sexual immorality, this is going to change your life forever. They do not regain the paths of life. You cannot take fire to your bosom and not be burned. You know, we live during a time when we think that there's a way to take fire in a safe manner. We could practice safe taking of fire. I just tell you that, well, maybe that's too blunt. There is no safe way to do that. Regardless of whatever kinds of means you want to employ. How's that for self-control? again, I'm falling back on this question about though David, man of God. Man of God, man after his own heart. How does that happen? How do you do that? In a moment, we're going to look at some of the qualities, I think, that describe the character of one of whom you could say that was true. But first, I've got a couple of more points I want to share with you from the story, and the lesson will be yours. Sin, people, is not content with just a little bit of foothold in our lives. Sin multiplies upon sin and compounds. So that when Paul says he became covetous and he learned from the law about covetousness, it produced all manner of evil desire within him. So what started perhaps with the sin of idleness, maybe you want to quibble with that and there was nothing wrong there. Okay, what started with the sin of looking too long compounded into the murder of his faithful servant Uriah. Sin is not content, and it will take over. And every time we give ourselves to it, every time we allow it another opportunity to be the king in our lives, we just got to wrap in another chain around ourselves. We're just twisting another rope that binds us to it. Another cord is what I was looking for. Next point is, consider the effect that this must have had on others. This great king, with the great legacy that he had, the stories about his faith, the young ones must have heard about him and Goliath, that he and Goliath. Now look at the people that he's implicating. Chapter 11, verse 3, you've obviously got those messengers who went and took her, that when David said, go and get her for me, they obeyed that command. They shouldn't have done that. He's the king. They shouldn't have done that. Verse 10. Look at how he implicated them. Chapter 11, that is. Verse 10. So when they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house. They didn't. Now they've got people. Now he's got people reporting for him. He's implicating them further in that, hey, this is what happened. What are we going to do now? They're helping him cover it up. See again, verse 17. Think about the people that died. Think about the people when Israel withdrew from Uriah, the collateral damage with the sin that David was committing was now affecting other families. And people were losing fathers. People were losing husbands. It wasn't just Uriah that died in that. There's collateral damage. Think about verses 18 through 20. Where it says, Joab sent and David all the things concerning war and charged messengers, saying, when you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, that if he gets upset with you, then you tell him about Uriah. So you're bringing these people in. God has a way of frustrating the plans of the wicked. I think that's another lesson we can learn from this. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 11. I'm just thinking that this is a pretty cool application of that point made in Job 5, verse 12, among other places. You've got the references there. Uriah did not go down to his house. We see again, he's arguing about the Ark of Israel and his Lord Joab, his brethren out in the field. And as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Now, how far do you have to look before you find a man like Uriah? I mean, is this you, men? I mean, come on, be real. You're out at war. You get an opportunity to come home. All right, I mean, okay. If it is, you're better than I am. I mean, you're away from your wife for that long. You just want the comforts of home for one night. He's so principled. It's like David must be saying, the way of the transgressor is hard here. Can you believe my luck? Can you believe he did that? Nobody does that. He did that. The way of the transgressor is hard, and God has a way of frustrating the plans of the wicked. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 5. How easy it is to condemn others even when we ourselves are overtaken with sin. So when David came to when Nathan came to David and told that story about the man with the little ewe lamb that was taken, and he cared for this lamb and nurtured it, and yet this rich man refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd. He took that poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. And David's anger was greatly aroused against the man and said to him, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die." Have you ever been that man, David, at that point? Have you ever found in your own life and experience, it's a lot easier to be harsh and judgmental about other people's sins than your own or your family's sins? You know, it's funny how that we can give the benefit of the doubt to people that we like and are close to. It's funny how we can all of a sudden be real understanding when it's family or someone close to us. I guess it's the judge not, Matthew chapter 7. It's the don't judge hypocritically. It's the don't judge hypercritically, and be consistent and impartial in your judgments. Next, guilt is not good for the soul. We know from Psalm 32, verses 3 through 5, that when David kept silent about his sin, it did not go well with him. Psalm 32, 3 says, "When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin." So while he kept silent, it did not go well for him. Proverbs 28, verse 13 says, "He who covers his sins will not prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will have mercy." That's Proverbs 28, verse 13. Every time a man sins, he faces one of these crossroads. We can cover it up. We can pretend it didn't exist. We can make excuses about it. We can blame other people for putting us in that position, or justify what we did in some other way. But to me, David, one of the reasons that David is who he is because of the way he confessed his sin. More on that in just a moment. While guilt is not good for the soul, confession is good for the soul. James chapter 5, verse 16 talks about confessing our sins to one another. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. It heals much. All right, finally, we need to remove the shackles. To remove the shackles of confessed sin. Hebrews chapter 13 talks about that, and this concerning Christians. I think you could talk about Christians and non-Christians alike. Romans chapter 6 talks about those who were bound to Satan and slaves for unrighteousness. Hebrews chapter 13 talks about... I'm sorry, it's Hebrews chapter 12. Let me go there and read that, since I misquoted it. Hebrews 12... Now I've misspoken. I hate it when I do that. Let us lay aside. Chuck, help me out. Lay aside the sin that so easily entangles us, and let's run with endurance. I mean, okay. Chapter 12, verse 1. It's right in front of my face. I've just got so many markings there, I can't even see it. "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." There. David, He got to that point where he recognized, I am weighted down, my flesh, my skin, my bones. I'm hurting my bones. I'm weary from carrying this. What is the Hebrew writer's answer for that? Lay it aside. Just set it aside. You know, at any point a man can cut the weights off. Remove them. It's going to take some of that poverty of spirit we talked about, some of that mourning. But after we've had this period of humility and we've confessed our sins, we've been open, we didn't make excuses about it, we can just break the shackles. And how free and how liberating that is. It sounds so easy, right? Lay aside the weight of sin. Yeah, it's easier said than done, you'd think, but no. As long as we don't care too much about what people think about us, that's going to be the thing that holds us back, is that the poor in spirit attitude is just not there. What is it about David? Let me give you this list all at once so that you can, if you're taking notes, you can get it and make sure to get it in time. David's a man with a great absolute faith. And of all these things that can be said about David, God knows these with great clarity. God knows our hearts. 1 Samuel 16:7 says just that. It says that God looks at the heart, man looks at the outward appearance, man looks at the things that people do and makes judgments about that before the time. God looks at the heart in every case. God knows the pain that David endured. God knows the guilt that he endured. He knows everything that about David that made him tick and why he did it and all of that, and certainly never to justify what he did. But at no time, you don't get the impression about what you know about David that he at any point was comfortable in his sin. This was tearing him apart, and God knew that. You see signs of his absolute faith in standing up to Goliath, his love for God's law, and his promise to meditate in it day and night. I like Psalm 119 is helpful for our purposes. Psalm 119, verse 34, shows David promising to obey it. Give me understanding, and I shall keep your law. Indeed, I shall observe it with my whole heart. You want to know how David can be called a man after God's heart? Even before there was a King David, God said, I'm going to find a man who will do all my will. That's a great testimony to who David was. Unless God was wrong about him, nobody's going to suggest that. David was a man who did his will. He was truly thankful. So many psalms about his thankfulness. He loved justice. We saw that in our own story, didn't we? We saw a little flare. We saw a flare of that righteous indignation and the justice and the kind of rule that he would have ruled Israel. He wouldn't stand for that sort of thing. He was truly repentant. Both Saul and David said, I have sinned. So what's the difference? One said, I have sinned, period. The other said, I have sinned, comma, yet now honor me. Return with me and honor me before the people. So that's pretty clear. You be the judge. And he loved God. We'll close with Psalm chapter 18, verse 1. Psalm 18, verse 1. I will love you, O Lord, my strength. Maybe too emotional for some, but no, this was the walk of God, of David with his God. It was a love relationship. Again, and God knew it. So what about you? I would venture to guess that lust, betrayal, deception, cover-ups are stories that some of us could tell about ourselves. I would be very surprised if murder was a part of that list. But if this could be said of David, that this was a man after God's own heart, And for some of us, we maybe even bear a part of that story. Isn't that a great message of hope? If David could be called a man after God's heart, I mean, there's an inference there, isn't there? That's available to me. You know, what a great breath of fresh air that is, that God might still look at me that way. Remember those qualities that we just shared there, though. He's not going to look at us that way if we're not repentant, if we don't love Him, if we don't, you know, meditate on His law, if we don't love justice and treat people with impartiality and that sort of thing, if we don't have all of those traits in the off-season, I don't know how to say that, but when we're not, like, in the middle of having lost our minds in sin, you know, when we are leading about a life in which we're not in that kind of turmoil, what if we're in a state of indifference toward God? What about a state of apathy? Then is God going to be able to say, that's a man after my own heart? Because when he sinned, he allowed himself to be convinced to kind of linger up to the front and let somebody say something about him doing something he shouldn't have, and then he went back to his life of apathy. That's not a man after God's own heart. We're all going to sin. We're all going to have failings, and some of them may be momentous. But what is the pattern of one's walk? There should be zeal there. There should be passion. And in spite of our failings, when we are restored, there needs to be godly, after the godly sorrow, there needs to be some zeal for the Lord. Just like in David's case, when he asked for forgiveness and he asked to be restored, he's automatically thinking about the lost. And I will teach sinners your ways. And he just longed for that fellowship with God. So maybe that applies to someone here tonight. We're about to sing a song of encouragement, at which point, if you've been touched by the message of God tonight and the opportunity, understanding that God loves all of us, and maybe you've fallen short, you've sinned in your life, we'd stand ready to help you and pray for you and do whatever is necessary to help you be restored to your God. Or if you've not obeyed the gospel yet and you need to name Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and confess that you believe that and turn from your sins, we'd be happy to help you and have you immersed in water to have your sins washed away. Whatever we can do to help, come forward now while we stand and sing.